Recording again. And again, anyone just let me know if you want me to take anything out of it. So now I'm going to talk about the Open Philanthropy Project. So the Open Philanthropy Project is kind of, it has a lot of similarities and some very important differences to GiveWell. So basically we were working on GiveWell when we met Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz a few years ago. And they were, you know, in some ways in a similar situation to what we were when we started GiveWell, and in some ways very different. So when Ellie and I started GiveWell, we were kind of like, we, you know, have full-time finance jobs. We would like to give a few thousand dollars this year. We'll have a couple hours to think about it. We'd like something kind of straightforward and really good. Carrie and Dustin were saying, you know, we are looking to give away a large personal fortune. We have several decades to do it. We have the resources to hire our own staff to spend decades thinking about these things, and we'd like to do it really well. And the commonality is that, like me and Ellie, I think Carrie and Dustin were not finding a lot of public intellectual discussion and debate about how to give as well as possible. And so the kind of similar call for someone to do the best job you can figuring out how to give and then write about it publicly so others can learn from it and we don't all need to reinvent the wheel was there. But a big difference is the kind of giving you want to do, because I think there's much less call for things that are proven, cost-effective, scalable, verifiable, and much more argument for doing things that might be very risky or very unconventional or things that no one else can do because they might involve creating organizations instead of funding existing ones, or transforming organizations, or just generally doing things that require a lot of trust and context and staff to see the case for. And so the Open Philanthropy Project has a similar mission to GiveWell. We try to find the best giving opportunities we can and write about it publicly so others can learn from our work. But it does have a completely different model and different approach, and increasingly different kind of like staff and day-to-day. So I was co-founder of GiveWell, but I now work on Open Philanthropy Project almost exclusively. I relate to GiveWell a little bit more as a board member, so I get involved in the kind of mid-year and end-year discussions, but it's not what I spend my time on. And Open Philanthropy Project is currently part of GiveWell, but we are working on changing that because we believe the two are fundamentally separate missions, and in particular, Open Philanthropy does a lot more kind of like debatable things than GiveWell, and we want the two to be separate organizations with separate brands so that you can give to one without giving to the other, for example. So we're working on the process of separating them. When they separate, I will work for the Open Philanthropy Project, I will be the executive director, and then, you know, GiveWell will be a separate organization. And, you know, where GiveWell looks for proven cost-effective, scalable charities, Open Phil, instead of looking for charities, we look for causes. And instead of proven cost-effective, scalable, we look for important, neglected, and tractable. And so, in other words, if we can find an issue, a problem in the world that is not getting enough attention for how important it is and for how tractable it is, then what we can do is we can hire around that issue, we can build expertise and context around that issue, and get to the point where we're able to look for the best grants in that issue, less by prioritizing evidence, though we do still care a lot about evidence because that's who we are, but more by kind of having the deep context, having the relationships, having the expertise, having the background to be able to spot what the best giving opportunities are, which is, you know, a very subjective thing and really relies on the people at Open Phil building trust relationships with each other. So, you know, Open Phil looks for, like I said, important, neglected, tractable causes. Another thing to know about Open Phil is we have an interest, it's not the only thing we do, but we have an interest in what we call hits-based giving. So we have a post about this on the Open Phil blog, which, by the way, recently became separate from the GiveWell blog. So there's a website, openphilanthropy.org. It has its own email list. It has its own blog. If you're not subscribed to it, then you're not seeing any news about Open Phil. So that's something to keep in mind. We have this interest in hits-based giving, which is this idea that you might try a lot of things that have a low chance of working, but if they worked, would be a big enough deal to make up for everything else. And this is kind of similar to how a lot of venture capitalists approach their work, where you might invest in 10 companies at an early stage, and 9 of them flame out, and one of them is Dropbox, and you did great. And that's kind of similar in philanthropy, that I think I can point to some cases where a philanthropist did something so forward-looking and so huge for the world that it would have been easy for them to have 10 other failures and still come out ahead, in some sense of you know, just doing the easy thing. And so that's why we're interested in hits-based giving. And when you do hits-based giving, things look very different. And so, you know, in my opinion, when you're looking for unlikely but potentially huge successes, you often are going to be attracted to things that are not already popular with expert consensus or with conventional wisdom. You're going to be looking for things that maybe only a small number of people can appreciate or have the context to really see the case for. And so a lot of the way Open Phil is structured is we pick our causes and then we decide which staff are going to be specializing in those causes. And often we hire specialized staff. And then once we have someone, let's say we have a cause like criminal justice reform, we'll have one staff member who is really leading the way on that cause. And the rest of us will look to defer to her and kind of ask good questions and make sure things are making sense and make sure the whole case holds together. But in the end, we want to have one person who has a great deal of context, who has all the relationships, who has all the background knowledge, who can consider all the arguments, but ultimately making their own personal subjective call about whether something is the best thing. We think that's a more promising route to doing really high upside and perhaps high risk things than trying to have a system that's more based on kind of universal standards of evidence or boxes to check or, you know, needing any kind of like universal staff consensus, which is not something we aim for at Open Phil. So that's, you know, a basic introduction to what we're about and our values. In terms of where we are, we spent the first few years of Open Phil really trying to pick causes. And so we had kind of a small staff, and the thing we wanted to do was find areas, issues to work on that we could really commit to. And so in 2014, we kind of announced a variety of, by the end of the year, we picked a variety of focus areas. And these are areas that we've chosen as important, neglected, tractable. I'll give examples in a second. And then in 2015, most of what we did that year was just hire. Was just look for staff who could help us pursue those causes. And now finally in 2016, we're in a position to do a fair amount of grant making, which we never were able to before. So, you know, total grant recommendations in 2015 were about $16 million. In 2016, I'm expecting something, you know, north of $50 million because now we have the staff to work on a bunch of causes and do things this way. So that's where we're at. And I'm going to start by just talking about what causes we're prioritizing on the U.S. policy front. And that's like an early category that we did some investigations on, picked some priorities, did some hiring. That'll give you a sense for just how we do things. Then I'm going to take a break and do questions. And then I'll talk about some of the other causes we're doing and Open Phil generally. So one of the, you know, broad areas we wanted to look at, or one of the broad categories, this is like bigger than a cause, this is kind of a category of cause, is, you know, this idea that when you're doing philanthropy, if you can fund people who make arguments that then change the direction of public policy, like what governments are doing, you could have a big multiplier on your giving. And even if you, again, if you fail 90% of the time, but 10% you play a real role in a policy change, you could end up with a pretty good value for money overall. We started with a focus on the US for totally pragmatic reasons. And as we've gotten deeper into our focus areas, we've gotten more, you know, open to looking at other countries as well. But we did feel that when we were getting started, we needed to stick with a policy landscape where it was feasible for us to network, to meet the right people, to do the right hiring, and to just understand the general background. So, you know, I think it wouldn't have been very practical to start a policy program that was, let's say, focused on Germany. I think that would have been kind of a travel and logistical and linguistic nightmare, and wouldn't have bought us really a lot of advantages that I can name. But it's not, you know, it's not because we value the U.S. more. It was a pragmatic decision to chase high value in this area. And what we did is we made a list of issues we could imagine working on that seemed like they could plausibly be important, neglected, and tractable. So, you know, there's some areas of policy that I can just look at and say, I don't think there's any chance that that is as important as some of these other things we're doing. But for plausible contenders, we tried to investigate and say, you know, here's a policy area. Let's say criminal justice reform, because that's one we actually picked. How much good could we accomplish with plausible reforms to the criminal justice system. And, you know, this was something we did with our cost effectiveness calculations that use kind of a, you know, a flexible framework that could be a long conversation, but we look for importance in terms of how much good could you imagine coming about from policy change. And then we look for neglectedness. So we say, who else works on this issue? Are there things that people could be doing that no one is doing because there isn't money to do them? And then finally, we look at tractability and we say, you know, could we imagine a win here? Could we imagine an impact here? Are there special reasons to think that this cause is promising in that way, is like politically doable or is not? And so causes that we ended up picking, you know, criminal justice reform, you know, briefly, the U.S. has a very high rate of incarceration compared to any other country. Really questionable whether all that incarceration is getting us much or anything on the margin in terms of public safety. And so the idea is that if we could have better policies, we might have a lot fewer people in prison. That could avert a lot of suffering as well as saving society money. And could also, you know, hopefully not have result in much of a hit, if anything, to public safety. David, who's here tonight, is working on a very thorough, maybe arguably unprecedentedly thorough, review of the literature on the effect of incarceration on crime, seeking out the highest quality studies, and in many cases, rerunning the data and code, reconstructing them himself, and looking for all the holes in them, and, you know, trying to nail down this question of whether we really do believe we could reduce incarceration without affecting public safety, or with having only a minor hit. And the, you know, preliminarily it looks like, and this our intuition going in, is that the answer is yes, and that there is room for improvement there. And the reason this cause ended up as a focus area of ours, you know, in terms of importance, we scored it as, you know, a moderate relatively, which means it's very important. It means there are some other causes we thought had higher importance. Neglectedness, we also had as a moderate. It's not the biggest policy field. It's not as big as, you know, well, there's a lot of areas that are bigger. But in terms of tractability, it's a bit of a standout because most causes, most U.S. policy issues you can imagine working on, a lot of the really big ones, a lot of the really important ones are kind of federal issues only. So immigration being an example, very hard to get much done, you know, by just advocating in California for better immigration law. And D.C. is not a very exciting place to be pushing for change right now, as some people might know. With criminal justice reform, a lot of the juice is state and local. And so you get a chance to pick your battles. Other issues, I think just there's a stably changing dynamic around criminal justice that we think presents opportunities in kind of a real and long-term way. And so, you know, when some people think of political opportunity, they might think of something that's in the headlines and maybe something will happen in the next few weeks. We think that's not the right time frame for philanthropists. So when we think about tractability, we think about durably changing factors that could matter for the next several years. And with criminal justice, the over the last couple decades, the rise in incarceration, the rise in expenses, the tightening of state budgets, the lowering of crime rates, which we actually think is not necessarily connected to the rise of incarceration, have created an environment where there's been a lot of reforms, and we think there could be a lot more. So criminal justice was chosen on that basis. And, you know, we spent several months looking for someone to hire to lead our work here. We hired Chloe Coburn, formerly of the ACLU. And basically our process is that Chloe is very well connected in the field, has a lot of background, has a lot of expertise, talks to everyone, tries to find the most exciting things, and then investigates them and answers a series of questions about how much value we're getting for per dollar, probabilistically, questions about, you know, how good the leadership is, what the downsides of a grant would be, why we should think the grant is special or outstanding. And then we review the case and we discuss with her. And then, you know, generally, I mean, in most cases, we end up making a grant when Chloe recommends it. And so that's kind of the system. That's the process for Open Phil. Other things that we're working on, another focus areas of ours is farm animal welfare. So animals are treated horrifically on factory farms. These are kind of, you know, the industrial agriculture that gets you your food. And, you know, we believe that there is actually a fair amount of interest in America in animal rights and animal welfare, but it does not tend to focus on farms, on factory farms, where the vast majority of animal suffering is occurring. And, you know, we think that's a cause that has high importance depending on exactly how you want to value animals, but certainly the numbers are huge and the amount of suffering is enormous, and also is relatively neglected for reasons I just said. And the tractability, we actually didn't really know much about it when we started our search, and I think on a lot of policy issues, the tractability is just a huge question mark because you never know what's going to happen. But we hired Lewis Ballard, who kind of came in and really convinced us that there's a particularly promising area of farm animal welfare right now, which is campaigns against corporations to encourage specific reforms in terms of treating animals better. And this is unsatisfying to a lot of people. I think a lot of the big donors in the space right now don't like it because they don't like the idea of acknowledging or working with the current system. They don't like the idea of treating animals maybe like less badly instead of just not having them, you know, in the farms at all. But the fact is, we think that there's been enormous successes of these corporate campaigns, and it's just been, you know, momentum and wins beyond what we would normally see in any issue. Sometime in basically within the last few months, there's been just a complete, you know, epidemic in some ways of cage-free pledges by grocers, by fast food companies, campaigned against by the groups that we are supporting. And, you know, our role in that victory, I think, is partial and is ambiguous, and I can get to. But, you know, that, I think, is going to affect an enormous number of chickens, these pledges to only sell cage-free eggs. We are convinced that it's going to affect the chickens very positively, and it's a win. It's momentum. It's the kind of thing that we think can pull more people into the field of pushing for animal welfare in a way that just kind of, you know, encouraging people to be vegan and mostly just not having an effect with that, I think would not be have the same kind of promise. And we believe that getting wins and getting momentum is historically very important to social movements and political movements and for pulling in talent. So we're incredibly excited about cage-free campaigns. We've done a series of grants to support groups working on them in the U.S. And now that we have kind of tried to cover everything we can there, we're looking internationally. So we're looking at China, India, EU, Latin America, Japan, and trying to see, you know, how much campaigning can we get done for better standards for animal welfare in those countries. So there are other focus areas in U.S. policy. Those are the only ones we have full-time people working on. We have some kind of quasi-focus areas that Alexander Berger spends part of his time on. He's a policy generalist. But I've been talking for a while, so I'm going to stop there and take questions. And then after a while, I will talk about some of the other causes we do. Yep.
This is kind of to give all an end open. But like, what are there other organizations that you see as having sort of like-minded approaches to things that you are a fan of that aren't GiveWell or OpenBowl?
Are there other organizations that I see as having a like-minded approach to things that I'm a fan of? I mean, certainly. We make grants, so there's a lot of organizations that I look at and I feel very excited about and I think are doing great work. I think it really depends, like, in what way and in what kind of alignment. I think, in terms of some of the groups that we felt excited to support in a very general way, Center for Global Development is a think tank that works on encouraging rich countries to take on, especially the U.S., to take on policies that are more friendly to the global poor. They have a lot of, like, in common with GiveWell in terms of they're really into transparency. It's very easy to tell what they're doing, what they're arguing, why they're arguing it. We think they have just like high intellectual standards and have had, you know, a great deal of impact. And we've actually done a historical case study on how they were founded, which we think a philanthropist had a major role in, and a study of their impact over the like 13 years or so, maybe 10 years since they were founded. And we've been very impressed with what they do. So I guess that's one example. Yep.
So it seems like the approach with OpenPhil is different from GiveWell in that rather than kind of hovering above the world of a particular area of charitable giving, you kind of immerse yourself in it, and
yep.
You go and you find experts in it and so forth. And I'm wondering if you're worried about being kind of like captured by the conventional wisdom in a particular area, which it seems like GiveWell is super duper skeptical and tries really hard to avoid that. Is that something that you think about, and how could you mitigate it?
Sure. So you know, immersing ourselves in the world and listening a lot to experts versus kind of being above it and being very skeptical. I mean, I think in some ways the two represent different worldviews that I think both have something to recommend them, and I think people can kind of pick which one they're more excited about. I personally think there's something to both. I think it's a little bit more of a gray area than maybe that sounds like. GiveWell does some immersion. I mean, we visit our top charities, we go check them out on the ground, we get to know the leadership, we get to know the development economists who work on the studies. Like, we want to have a rich contextual sense of the issues so that we interpret the data intelligently. We don't think that the whole thing can be reduced to a formula, even on the GiveWell side. And on the open fill side, I mean, we definitely immerse ourselves and we definitely try to find people with context, but we also try to cross the gap from people with deep expertise to, you know, more like people like me who are making these high-level cross-cause decisions who don't know everything. And I do ask a lot of critical questions, and I point out when things don't make sense, and I kind of spot check things, and I push on things, and I say, you know, this isn't adding up. What is the reason for that? This is a big, important seeming claim. Can we push on that? And, you know, it's not just me. I mean, I think and it's not even just the staff in that kind of position, the cross-cause selection position. It's also just a general habit that we try to identify claims that seem important and that don't seem obvious and that we feel we could learn more about, and we try to learn more about them. So David's work is an excellent example of that, where, sure, if you talk to people in the criminal justice reform field, they all agree it's completely obvious that putting people in prison does absolutely nothing to reduce public... You know, this is a little bit exaggerated, but there's certainly a lot of people who you can get a sense of an echo chamber that, you know, why would you ever even put someone in prison? But that's why we have this incredibly thorough, you know, literature review going on, that I think is very skeptical and is very, you know, let's look at the data and be data-based. And, you know, similarly, I mean, we've had some arguments about whether cage-free systems are really better for chickens. Well, there's a big literature on that, and we're about to start diving into it. I mean, we already know a fair amount about it, and we've already got our view, but we're going to try and dive into it more. So, you know, I think there is a mix. That said, I think if you want to do the hits-based giving approach, you should be less afraid of being in a bubble. I think if you want things that definitely work and that are hard to argue with, you should be very worried about being in a bubble, be very skeptical, look for evidence of everything. That's more the GiveWell way. And if you want some massive wins that no one else saw coming, sometimes you want to be in a bubble, because sometimes you want to be believing something and seeing something that most people in the world don't see. And the people who do see it are the ones who are most interested in it. And so those are the ones you end up talking to. And so I think these bubbles, you know, they can be scary, but they can also be productive. And I think some wonderful things have come out of people in intellectual bubbles. So, you know.
You did move to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, exactly. so we do try to, you know, strike a middle ground. I do think we are doing something different from just saying, you know, screw critical thinking, we're just going to listen to our friends. But I also think that we are doing less of the, you know, we're going to pass up this giving opportunity just because it feels like an echo chamber. I think some things do feel like echo chambers, and you have to ask yourself on the merits, you know, what's the best argument you've heard against, and evaluate that. Yep.
I was just interested in a little more about, you had just mentioned, like, the evidence for cage-free, like, actually being better, and that was something I'm vegetarian and am pro the approach mm-hmm. of, like, make incremental changes. But my current impression was, like, cage-free meant instead of, like, 100 chickens in 1-foot by 1-foot cages, they were in, like, 100-foot by 10 cage. I didn't do my math right, but whatever. and that, like, yeah. It's approximately as bad, and also they can, like, peck at each other and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I'm curious, like, what's your, like, I don't know, at a high level,
right.
What's your current understanding of that?
High level understanding of cage-free chickens. So cage-free has a specific meaning. It requires a specific certification. There are definitely questions about whether cage-free pledges translate to using those systems and meeting those specifications. Those are things that we believe continued advocacy will be needed to stay on top of. But in a nutshell, there is a lot more space per chicken. Under a cage-free system. It's per chicken, not just, you know. There's a lot more space per chicken under a cage-free system, and the main literature we're working off of is the best literature review we know of that basically tries to survey all the studies of different systems and then score them according to which factors there are for chicken welfare. That could include things like mortality, where we think it's ambiguous and maybe even worse in the non-cage-free system, or in the cage-free systems, but it also includes, are the chickens able to engage in chicken behaviors, in natural chicken behaviors? And so, you know, I think that is where you see a big bump up on cage-free. There's just like, several really core chicken behaviors that chickens are able to do that escape, the details escape me, and this is why we have Lewis. I've definitely reviewed this and looked at this, and that part is pretty convincing to me, that you get a serious change in welfare there, but that is something we do want to look into more. Yep.
You kind of describe the dichotomy of the factory farming system as either like the approach of working with companies and trying to get them to lessen the horribleness of what they're doing versus like telling everyone to go vegan and kind of changing the cultural understanding that way. But there's, I think, a third prong of the issue that I'm wondering if you've looked into at all, especially because you mentioned that this was kind of one of your political issues, which is just the fact that there's almost no prohibitive legislation on factory farming mm-hmm. whatsoever, both federally and state by state. And as a result, a lot of small farming towns kind of get huge, many thousand animal factory farms coming in and polluting the water system and having the animal welfare issues. Like, is that a side
sure.
issue that you're looking into at all?
Sure. Are we looking into legislation on factory farming? I mean, it's definitely something we could do. It's definitely something that's on the list of things to consider. And I think there has been some important legislation or legislative campaigns in the past that have put certain issues on the map. But when we look at the factory farming strategy is to kind of have a list of all the things we could do and kind of go down the list in order of what we guess is best. And if it looks amazing, we should, recommend some grants right away. And if not, we should move to the next thing and kind of, make a landscape. And so far, it just feels like, Lewis came in very excited about these cage-free campaigns. And since he's come in, we've seen them get even more successful than any of us had anticipated. And just the wins there and the value for money. I mean, I'm personally, my own best shot at the philosophy questions, do not make me think that that animals should be given, a large moral weight relative to humans. But even I look at these numbers and I just say, wow, it's like, multiple chickens moving out of cages per dollar spent or something like that is our calculation. And so the corporate campaigning looks really good, and it just looks really effective, and it's just very different from going for a passing a bill, because you only need to convince, kind of one decision maker who's worried about their brand. And it's often not a huge extra expense for them and things like that. And then, as soon as we kind of finished that, we said, well, is there much of this going on in other countries? And it was like, well, there's a lot of opportunities to fund better work in other countries. So, I think the legislative stuff is definitely on the table, but frankly, I think there are other things that just look more promising to us, and that is a subjective judgment. But I think, it's not possible to, to get to an objective view on that. And I think instead what we want to do is move quickly toward the things that are most exciting to the person that we've selected as our best shot at the person who's going to make good choices here. Yeah.
With open fill, as you're getting into issues that are more political for people, have you thought about what kind of issues that's going to present for your organization, the funding structure? I mean, I've assumed the fact structure will support ending up with things that don't fit conventionally together to piss off one side or the other, and just have you thought about how you'll manage or deal with that, those kind of issues?
Sure. I mean, how are we approaching potentially politically controversial issues from the standpoint of our brand? I mean, point one is to separate GiveWell and OpenPhil, because I think GiveWell does non-controversial things and doesn't need to start, getting heat from everyone who has an issue with, controversial decisions OpenPhil is making. And this is a part of that trade-off again. I think if you want things that are non-controversial that work, I think GiveWell is a good choice. And if you want to be really ambitious and shoot higher, I think it would be a mistake to just say, and we can't do anything uncontroversial. It's separating them is answer number one. In terms of do we want to try and be bipartisan or take sides, I mean, the way that we try to do it is we try to look for issues that, we try to look at each issue and try to decide on the merits of the issue. We are not really interested in kind of like trying to balance the number of partnerships we have with each political party. We're also not interested in announcing that we are, loyalists to one political party and we're just going to do everything to help that party and everything they believe in. So to us, it's really just case specific, and we aren't really working to we aren't really working to be balanced, and we aren't really looking to be loyalist. We're just looking to do the right thing on a given issue and finding things that are important, neglected, and tractable.
Yeah, I was trying to ask more, like, I'm assuming you want to go after things, even if they have to be controversial,
yeah,
and that the odds are they won't all line up in one direction, so you can just have a consistent set of funders, and just,
yeah,
you know, how do you, I mean, do you feel confident to be able to pursue that sort of direction, or is just,
yeah,
day by day?
Yeah, I mean, do we feel we'll be able to pursue multiple directions? I think we can. I mean, I think our position, what we do, does not really require loyalism. I think, in other words, if you say to someone, we love your work, we would like to support you financially, they don't usually come back with, like, but are you, you know, what's your position on this thing? They'll say, you know. And so, you know, as a funder, I think that's, like, a reasonably okay way to be. You know, I could certainly imagine that there are issues where we could imagine that getting involved in the issue could jeopardize a lot of our other work very seriously. And if we did that, we wouldn't necessarily be public about that, because our mission is to share information so that other people can learn, which is different from kind of sharing everything we ever decide. And so, you know, we think it's perfectly consistent to say we want to be open, we want to talk about this stuff intellectually, we want to help people understand how we're thinking. Also, some of the things we do are not necessarily going to be talked about in public because of, you know, when we perceive that the things we could do could jeopardize our other work. Yep.
So in the area of, say, farm welfare, there's a lot of things you could do that doesn't involve, you know, political lobbying, trying to get laws changed. Are there such opportunities in the area of criminal justice reform, or is it mostly just trying to get, you know, laws changed?
Yeah. Are we just trying to get laws changed in criminal justice reform? Because it's true that in farm animal welfare, there's a whole set of important decision makers that, you know, they're corporations, and if they change their minds, then that affects animals. I think that's not as true in criminal justice. I mean, I think this is a policy issue, and it's really hard to do much about that issue without getting policy changed. But, I mean, there are, you know, certainly it's not the case. There are a lot of things we can do that are not just about trying to get policy change. So, for example, prosecutors. You know, I think there's a general feeling that a lot of prosecutors are just trying to be maximally tough on crime and lock up as many people as they can, and that's how they relate to their job, and that's what they believe makes them a good prosecutor. If you could change that culture by kind of highlighting some of the ways in which a prosecutor can be good other than getting people locked up, such as, you know, saving money for their community and averting unnecessary suffering, then I think, you know, that is an area that we have active interest in and have made some grant recommendations in. So there is some of that, but generally everything intersects with the legal system because, you know, all the choices about who goes to jail and prison are in that system. So I'm going to now talk about some of the other causes we're working on, and then I'll take questions till the end. So another kind of broad category of thing we're interested in is what we call global catastrophic risks. So these are, you know, climate change would be an example. Asteroid strikes would be another example. Pandemics would be a third. These are things that, like, could happen that could be very bad for global civilization. And kind of the theory here is there's a couple arguments for why you might expect these to be good things for a philanthropist to work on. One is there's comparative advantage. So if we're all worried about, you know, some kind of global issue knocking all of human civilization off course, it's not always easy to point to one company or one government whose job it is to worry about that. And that kind of makes a natural fit for philanthropy. I think another part of the reasoning here is that a lot of the basic dynamics of disasters is that as they get bigger, they don't necessarily get less probable as quickly as they get bigger. And so it might be that a really bad pandemic is, you know, fairly unlikely, and a super, super, super bad pandemic is only, like, more unlikely than that, but not a great deal. And so the idea is that because of how interconnected the world is, certain things going wrong could have really amplified global self-reinforcing effects. And therefore, we could imagine that if we did things to help global civilization become better prepared for something that threatens all of global civilization as an interconnected whole, we might be able to get a multiplier and get good value for money. The thing we did was similar. We looked at all the things we can imagine kind of being big threats to human civilization. We ranked them according to importance, or scariness in this case, if you prefer, neglectedness and tractability. And the two that we've really honed in on that I really do believe are kind of especially strong on these three criteria, by a decent margin. So one of them is biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. So basically, if I were if you told me that human civilization was either going to go completely extinct or fundamentally get knocked off course in the next 20 years or the next 50 years, the next 100 years, and I had to guess how, a pandemic would be one of my top guesses. And that could be either a natural pandemic. There was one after World War I that actually killed more people and in a much shorter time than World War I itself. Or I could guess at a synthetic pandemic as the state of biology advances, and you see the risk that people are able to kind of craft their own pandemics. And so that would be, I think, very high on the scariness scale. I think there is a big government infrastructure around preventing pandemics, but I think there is a lack of philanthropy, and I think philanthropy can have a special role to play here, especially around looking at far out worst cases. So I think a lot of the government work is around preventing, tragic but not civilization threatening pandemics, and in terms of trying to think through what the very worst case could look like and whether the preparations for that look any different. I think there is a lack of attention there. So we recently, we basically spent an entire year trying to hire someone for this. And we recently did hire Jamie Asif, who's now going to be working with Howie Lempel. The two of them, I think this is a big complicated field, and the two of them are both going to be working full time on this. And this has only been going on for 6 or 7 weeks. So we expect in the next few months that we'll have a bunch of grants to make the world more prepared for the next pandemic. And then the other cause is potential risk from advanced artificial intelligence, which is probably an example for many people of something that sounds way too wacky to actually work on. It's it's kind of a hotly debated issue these days. The question is, there's been a lot of exciting progress in machine learning and artificial intelligence research in the last 5 years or so. And the question is whether we're getting anywhere close to a day when you could imagine AIs or machine learning systems that are really intelligent in a broad array of domains, that are able to process information and make kind of superhuman decisions, not just in board games, not just in math, but in things like making predictions about how society will evolve and what kinds of actions one can take to achieve a desired result. That could speed up science a lot. That could lead to very powerful technologies coming a lot quicker than anyone is expecting. And some of the concerns here, I think, there's a lot of reasons to expect this could be a very good thing. But some of the concerns, one of them is if you have, arguably human intelligence is the thing that has changed the world the most to date. And if you had something that was more powerful than human intelligence at finding technologies, finding solutions, finding strategies, that is a top candidate for something that would, possibly really change civilization and give a great deal of power to whoever kind of has access to that technology first. And so we have kind of two categories of risk. One of them is misuse risk, and this is kind of what happens if you have a very powerful artificial intelligence that through hacking or through government programs becomes a tool of, let's say, an authoritarian government or someone who, has bad intentions. That's like one of the worst things I can imagine happening. It's very speculative. The technology's not there yet, but we won't necessarily get a big warning shot when the technology comes. It's not like medicine where you have, 10 years of randomized controlled trials while you're figuring out whether you can put a drug on the market. These things can make big leaps in capabilities, and I don't think anyone has much of a roadmap in front of them. And then, the other kind of risk is accident risk. And so the question is, what if you have an AI system that in many respects is better at accomplishing goals than any human is, but that also has some kind of fatal bug, that is missing some crucial piece of the world, that didn't have the correctly specified value function that it's optimizing for? In some ways, the one of the worst cases I can imagine for human civilization is that you have a superhuman intelligence that has a non-human friendly goal, whether due to accidents, bad programming, bad user, whatever. So I know a lot of this probably sounds very speculative and sci-fi-y. I think in some ways it is. But I have become convinced over the last year or so that I think there is a reasonable chance that this is not a far-off, never-to-be-occurring event. And I think that would be a long conversation, and we wrote a very long blog post about it that still only scratches the surface. But I do think, you know, kind of the thing that I'm saying is I believe in a non-trivial probability, so kind of like at least 10% and definitely over 1%, that within the next 20 years, we'll see the kind of artificial intelligence that has really superhuman abilities in a large number of very important domains and can fundamentally transform the world because of it. And I think once you believe that this could be a 20-year issue, I think as a philanthropist, that kind of means act now. Because, you know, the timescales we work on trying to build fields, encourage people to start organizations, help organizations grow to the point where there can later be impact, I think it's a major issue. So this is a potential risk for advanced AI is a very challenging cause for us. It's not like criminal justice where we could hire one person who kind of knows everything that's going on. It's kind of a, you know, it's a field that a lot of people don't even really believe is or should be a field. You know, the field of like technical research to prevent the kind of bugs I'm talking about is not really big in mainstream academia at this time. Hopefully that can and will change. And so we haven't really been able to find one person that we think can do it all. We think it's a time-intensive cause at this time to lay the groundwork for ourselves to make better grants in the future. And so we have multiple staff working on it this year, and I'm personally spending a fair amount of time on it. And one of the reasons I'm in New York is because when we work on an issue, we think about something a lot in the abstract, and I like opportunities to see the work we're doing up close, like a site visit. And so I'm here at ICML, which is one of the premier machine learning conferences, and that's a chance to just kind of see the whole AI research community in one place, see them all interacting, see them presenting research to each other, talking, and get to know just how they're thinking about these issues, something I already know a fair amount about because we've done this less systematically, but you know, that is something we're spending a decent amount of time on this year. And we've kind of set it up as a large priority, partly because I think this cause really does score very high on importance, neglectedness, and tractability. And also because I just think the challenges of it are such that it needs more time than other causes at this stage in the game, and hopefully that changes later. So those are some other things we're doing. There's a lot of other stuff going on at OpenPhil too. We recently brought on 3 science advisors who are going to try and help us do this same important, neglected, tractable exercise for fields of scientific research, which is very challenging. It could take years. We have a history of philanthropy project trying to learn from what philanthropists have done well in the past. We recently put out a couple of case studies on that. But at this point, I'm going to take questions for another 10 or 15 minutes. Questions? Yep.
So maybe just this kind of is my question from before. So where GiveWell may seem like it's a little bit too targeted to some people, this can possibly be seen as going the complete opposite end of the direction.
Arguably.
Like, is there an opportunity to go almost that far, or maybe back up a little bit?
Yeah. One question would be, is there something in between GiveWell and OpenPhil? In some ways there are. So the GiveWell experimental work is looking for new future top charities. It's more speculative and high risk than GiveWell. It's less controversial than some of the OpenPhil stuff. I think OpenPhil has quite a range in terms of controversiality or weirdness. Like, I think pandemic preparedness is a much more mainstream and, you know, kind of normal idea than potential risk from advanced AI. So I think there is a range we're covering. I mean, I will say in general that I have an easier time seeing the case for doing something really rigorous and self-skeptical and totally evidence-based. And I have an easier time seeing the case for doing something where you're really just going all out for the biggest home run you could possibly hit. And I see a less compelling case at this stage in, you know, in my kind of intellectual development for this middle ground where you're kind of taking risks but also holding yourself back. So it's not as exciting an idea to me, but I think there is a span within GiveWell and OpenPhil, and, you know, there's also plenty of opportunities for other people to, you know, to try and find that middle ground themselves. I think in some ways one of the best public goods we can provide is exploring what the extremes look like and giving demonstrations of, you know, how to talk about giving publicly when you're being very evidence-based, how to talk about it publicly when you're being more out there. I think it makes the middle ground easier to explore, but, you know, we are most interested in the two ends of the spectrum. Yep.
So this is a little philosophical, but how do you guys value
Yeah.
But how do you also take into account like positive psychology studies and like happiness in general, just social connectivity and communication?
Yeah. Yeah, how do we trade off all the different, you look at these different causes and it's like some of them are trying to maybe stop human civilization from going off course, some of them are trying to reduce chicken suffering, some of them are trying to reduce malaria. How do you compare all that? You know, the most general answer is that at GiveWell and OpenPhil, we generally try to cultivate an attitude of being very deeply engaged with these tough philosophical questions, but also very pragmatic and not letting them hold us back or stop us or dominate our work. So we don't want to be in a position where we can't do anything until we decide exactly what we think about philosophy of consciousness, even though philosophy of consciousness matters a lot. And we don't want to be in a position where everything we're doing only makes sense if you endorse one particular philosophical view. And so, you know, we try to strike that middle ground, and what it often means is taking our best guess, diversifying a bit across different defensible worldviews. So in other words, you know, I think there's an argument that that animal suffering is the most promising direction because it depends on your philosophical views about animals and other things. There's an argument that this global catastrophic risk prevention is the most promising direction. As long as I feel legitimately uncertain and feel like I could change my mind and take on any of these pretty soon, I think there is a case along multiple dimensions for doing some of each, especially given the amount of resources that we're recommending at this point. That we, you know, we can hit diminishing returns, we can be one of the biggest funders basically in all the fields I just named at once. And that seems better than just picking one and, you know, and trying to put everything in there. So, you know, we try to balance them. In terms of the cost effectiveness calculations, like, we calculate cost effectiveness usually either in terms of like lives or life years, or in terms of like economic value created in terms of dollars. But we also will entertain arguments that under kind of like standard models of utility, money is worth more when you have less of it. And so in other words, you could argue, for example, that GiveDirectly is 100x return because you're taking money from a country where the average income is something like $30,000 to, you know, a community where the income of the recipients is something like $300 a year. And so, you know, you're taking money from one place that has 100x as much of it, and on some models that would be 100x return. And so, you know, those are some of the main assumptions and views and metrics that we use to compare things. But a lot of times when things are incommensurable, we'll just kind of say, as long as either one looks like it could really be the best, we'd be happy to do both. And I think we are interested in getting more rigorous about how to make these comparisons. And that might be like, you know, a future project, but it's not the main thing we're working on right now. I should turn this way. I keep forgetting to do that. Yeah.
It's kind of related to that. Either organization, how do you measure your impact? I mean, you were saying that it can be ambiguous.
Sure. How do we measure our impact? So, you know, one measure of impact is money moved. So it's, you know, how many dollars did we cause to be given to things based on our recommendation? That measure is pretty easy. I think the question that then becomes, how good is our recommendation and how much more good is the money doing under our recommendation than otherwise? That's the much harder question to answer. You know, I will say, so we've made some attempt to answer it, and I would mostly, you know, I would mostly say it's like, if you look at the money moved and you look at our operating expenses and you believe that we're kind of making the giving, you know, 2x as effective or more, it comes out looking very good. And I think there's good reasons to believe we are doing that. For example, like variation even between our top charities looks like arguably 10x. But, you know, another thing to realize is that under OpenPhil, I believe that philanthropy is one of the areas where you're going to gain the most by being non-insistent on always being able to get the feedback loops and get the metrics. I think one of the things that distinguishes philanthropy is that you are able to fund things where the only argument is that this seems like a really good idea, and it may not pay off for 20 years, it may pay off with only 10% probability, you may never really see the results, and you're not going to have a profit bottom line. I think that is a comparative advantage of philanthropy, and I think it'd be a mistake to leave it on the table. So our general attitude is to evaluate ourselves wherever evaluation seems feasible, but not cut off work just because it can't be evaluated. And so there is a great deal of OpenPhil work where we say, honestly, this grant is like a 10% chance of being great over the next 10 years. We're not going to know anything about it anytime soon. But we can review our whole portfolio every 5 years and say, did we get some big wins? And if not, we've got a problem. And at least that is worth something. And we can take the big wins and we can vet, you know, one or two of them with an actual historian, which is another thing we're currently doing for other big wins with the History of Philanthropy Project. Yeah, Colin. What can we actually do about potential risks for advanced AI? So there's the two classes of risk, misuse and accidents. So first I'll talk about accidents. So, you know, this idea that you could misspecify a program or that you could have a bug in it that causes it to be kind of a really scary combination of intelligence and stupidity in a sense, or intelligence and non-human friendly values. There, I think there are a series of technical questions. Like, we're already seeing some of the opportunities to have this kind of screw up in today's promising machine learning systems. So for example, a reinforcement learner is a kind of system that learns from reward. And so it does something, and maybe it's playing a video game, it presses a button, it looks at its score, it presses a button, it looks at its score, and without having that score, it's not able to have any kind of like way to direct its experiments and learn. And so it's kind of a popular framework to have a machine learning system learn that way. The problem is, once the machine learning system gets broad enough, and instead of just looking at the video game, it's looking at the whole world, it may notice itself and its own code and its own reward channel, and it may realize that the best way to get a high score is to hack into itself and set its score really high, which could actually be a bigger problem if that also involves making sure that no human ever shuts it off, and then it gets to run as long as possible, and maybe as fast as possible. So that's kind of, that's an example of something that I don't think anyone has a totally satisfying, easy solution to how you get a reinforcement learner to not hack itself. But there are a bunch of ideas. I think the ideas need to be worked out. There's some concrete technical challenges. There will be, basically, in the next couple days, there will be a paper that I think is probably better than stuff that's been out there before that sheds light on a lot of this. So hopefully we'll cover it in our blog within the next couple weeks. But it will have a nice, very concrete technical description of some of the challenges. Now, what about misuse? You know, how do you stop this from getting into the wrong hands when it doesn't even exist yet? I think basically there are a series of potential policy and regulatory challenges with a general artificial intelligence or just a broad scope artificial intelligence that I don't think by default would be well handled by current legal and regulatory frameworks. You have kind of potentially a system that is simultaneously a medical research tool and a weapon, things like that, and figuring out at what point you need to start regulating it and how you should regulate it and who should regulate it, and what international agreements should exist on who gets to control and deploy such a thing, I think is basically something that no one is thinking about. We would like people to start thinking about it. I think that would be productive. And I think even though these things could be a long way off, starting to analyze the potential scenarios and starting to have, realize what are some of the things we could actually do and what would be some of the non-obvious pitfalls and some of the non-obvious options, something I'd like to see happening. So that's something, that's also work we'd like to fund. And that could be at, academic think tanks and things of that nature. I take like one or two more. Yeah.
First, just a quick comment on how you evaluate yourself. I think that at least in the cases that I'm aware, you should also consider that you might be increasing the amount of money people donate as they read your research and become comfortable donating more because they know what the effect is. But I really want to ask about OpenPhil. I have no idea how OpenPhil is funded, and I imagine it'd be really hard to get GiveWell donors generally to fund it, even though it is exciting, just because the alternative, like you said, is low-hanging fruit. But have you considered that like people who currently donate significantly to GiveWell could be useful like beyond their donations, just as people who may work in a related field or have a relationship with their congressmen and so on?
Sure. So how do we fund OpenPhil, and have we thought about how donors could help in ways other than giving? OpenPhil currently is just part of GiveWell, and it's funded out of the GiveWell general budget. That's something we want to change. We anticipate that it's going to be funded when it separates by Good Ventures, which is our main partner for the time being, and we think that'll be probably the simplest way for things to be, because that is, you know, that is where a lot of the grant making is coming from, and that kind of makes the most sense. In terms of donors helping us out, I mean, anyone who has ideas for how they might be able to help us out, definitely get in touch. Usually we look to our program officers to lead the way on figuring out what needs to be done and who are the best people to contact to do it. I'll take one more question, then I'll hang around and talk for people who want to talk. Who's got the last question? Yeah.
Have you thought about, as a catastrophe, scenarios where the sun gets blocked out and you need to, like, think of new ways to make food in a hurry? Which is something that Dave Denkenberger from a GCRI has kind of proposed.
Sure. Have we thought about scenarios where agriculture is severely affected and you need quick ways and unusual ways to make food? I think this is an interesting idea. I think it cuts across a few potential global catastrophic risks, including, you know, some of the worst possible effects of supervolcanoes, nuclear war, and climate change. You know, I it's something we would consider. I think we would need to get more into the science to be really excited about it, and it's not super high on the priority list, because I think if I'm naming the two things that could really knock civilization off course, they look more like pandemics and AI, in my opinion. That could be a long conversation I'd be happy to have with people afterward. But I think the set of risks that I would associate with primarily operating through agriculture and the food supply, I think is, you know, to me is adding up to a smaller risk in terms of that massive disruption. Now, I think, you know, climate change is a huge global issue, and I think one of the most important issues in the world, and something that I really wish more were being done about. But I think in terms of that knock civilization off course probability, I think that's on a longer time frame with a lower probability than the other two things I said, though still pretty scary in the scheme of things. So with that said, thanks everyone for coming. I really appreciate all the questions, and more so appreciate all the support that you folks provide to our top charities and to us. You make our work possible, and we really appreciate your sort of openness to, you know, to this being your charity event. It's very different from most charity events, and we love that. So thanks everyone, and I will stick around a little bit to chat.